people and drove home like a maniac, imagining him waiting impatiently on the doorstep. There was no one outside her house, and no sign of his rusty Datsun. She went inside and put the food in the refrigerator. She took the eggs out of the carton and put them in the egg tray, undid the six-pack of beer, and loaded the coffee machine ready to start. Then she had nothing to do again. It occurred to her that she was behaving uncharacteristically. She had never before worried about whether a man might be hungry. Her normal attitude, even with Will Temple, had been that if he's hungry, he'll fix himself something to eat, and if the refrigerator is empty, he'll go to the store, and if the store is closed, he'll get drive-through. But now she was suffering an attack of domesticity. Steve was having a bigger impact on her than other men, even though she had known him only a few days. The doorbell sounded like an explosion. Jeannie leaped up, heart pounding, and spoke into the entry phone. "Yes? Jeannie? It's Steve." She touched the button that unlocked the door. She stood still for a moment, feeling foolish. She was acting like a teenage girl. She watched Steve come up the stairs in a gray T-shirt and loose-fitting blue jeans. His face showed the pain and disappointment of the last 24 hours. She threw her arms around him and embraced him. His strong body felt tense and strained. She led him into the living room. He sat on the sofa and she switched on the coffee machine. She felt very close to him. They had not done the usual things, dated and gone to restaurants and watched movies together, the way Jeannie had previously got to know a man. Instead, they had fought battles side by side and puzzled over mysteries together and been persecuted by half-hidden enemies. It had made them friends very quickly. "Want some coffee?" He shook his head. "I'd rather hold hands." She sat beside him on the couch and took his hand. He leaned toward her. She turned up her face, and he kissed her lips. It was their first real kiss. She squeezed his hand hard and parted her lips. The taste of his mouth made her think of wood smoke. For a moment, her passion was derailed as she asked herself if she had brushed her teeth. Then she remembered that she had, and she relaxed again. He touched her breast through the soft wool of her sweater, his big hand surprisingly gentle. She did the same to him, rubbing the palms of her hands across his chest. It got serious very quickly. He pulled away to look at her. He stared into her face as if he wanted to burn her features into his memory. With his fingertips, he touched her eyebrows, her cheekbones, the tip of her nose and her lips, as gently as if he were afraid of breaking something. He shook his head from side to side slightly, as if he could not believe what he saw. In his gaze, she saw profound longing. This man yearned for her with all his being. It turned her on. Her passion blew up like a sudden wind from the south, hot and tempestuous. She felt the sensation of melting in her loins that she had not had for a year and a half. She wanted everything all at once, his body on top of her, and his tongue in her mouth, and his hands everywhere. She held his head and pulled his face to her and kissed him again, this time with her mouth open wide. She leaned backward on the couch until he was half lying on her, his weight crushing her chest. Eventually, she pushed him away, panting, and said, "Bedroom." She untangled herself from him and went into the bedroom ahead of him. She pulled her sweater over her head and threw it on the floor. He came into the room and closed the door behind him with his heel. Seeing her undressing, he took off his T-shirt with one swift movement. "They all do that," she thought. "They all close the door with their heel." He pulled off his shoes, unbuckled his belt, and took off his blue jeans. His body was perfect, broad shoulders and a muscular chest and narrow hips in white jockey shorts. "But which one is he?" He moved toward her, and she took two steps back. The man on the phone said, "He could visit you again." He frowned. "What's the matter?" She was suddenly scared. "I can't do this," she said. He took a deep breath and blew hard. "Wow," he said. He looked away. "Wow." She crossed her arms on her chest, covering her breasts. "I don't know who you are." Comprehension dawned. Oh, my God! He sat on the bed with his back to her, and his big shoulders slumped dispiritedly. But it could have been an act. You think I'm the one you met in Philadelphia? I thought he was Steve. But why would he pretend to be me? It doesn't matter. He wouldn't just do it in the hope of a sly fuck, he said. My doubles have peculiar ways of getting their kicks, but this isn't one of them. If he wanted to fuck you, he'd pull a knife on you, or rip your stockings, or set fire to the building, wouldn't he? I got a phone call, Jeannie said shakily. Anonymous. He said the one you met in Philadelphia was supposed to kill you. He got carried away and messed up, but he could visit you again. That's why. You have to leave. Now. She snatched up her sweater from off the floor and pulled it on hastily. It did not make her feel any safer. There was sympathy in his gaze. Poor Jeannie, he said. The bastards have scared you good. I'm sorry. He stood up and pulled on his jeans. Suddenly, she felt sure she was wrong. The Philadelphia clone, the rapist, would never start dressing again in this situation. He would throw her on the bed and tear off her clothes and try to take her by force. This man was different. This was Steve. She felt an almost irresistible desire to fling her arms around him and make love to him. Steve, he smiled. That's me. But was this the aim of his act? When he had won her confidence, and they were naked in bed, and he was lying on top of her, would he change and reveal his true nature, the nature that loved to see women in fear and pain? She shuddered with dread. It was no good. She averted her eyes. You'd better go, she said. You could question me, he said. All right. Where did I first meet Steve? At the tennis court. It was the right answer, but both Steve and the rapist were at JFU that day. Ask me something else. How many cinnamon buns did Steve eat on Friday morning? He grinned. 8, I'm ashamed to say. She shook her head despairingly. This place could be bugged. They've searched my office and downloaded my email. They could be listening to us now. It's no good. I don't know Steve Logan that well, and what I do know, others might know too. I guess you're right, he said, putting his T-shirt back on. He sat on the bed and put on his shoes. She went into the living room, not wanting to stand in the bedroom and watch him dress. Was this a terrible mistake, or was it the smartest move she had ever made? She felt a bereft ache in her loins. She had wanted so badly to make love to Steve. Yet the thought that she might have found herself in bed with someone like Wayne Statner made her shaky with fear. He came in, fully dressed. She looked into his eyes, searching for something there, some sign that would assuage her doubts, but she did not find it. I don't know who you are. I just don't know. He read her mind. It's no use, I can tell. Trust is trust, and when it's gone, it's gone. He let his resentment show for a moment. What a downer. What a motherfucking downer. His anger scared her. She was strong, but he was stronger. She wanted him out of the apartment, and fast. He sensed her urgency. Okay, I'm leaving, he said. He went to the door. You realize he wouldn't leave. She nodded. He said what she was thinking. But until I really leave, you can't be sure. And if I leave and come right back, that doesn't count either. For you to know it's me, I have to really go away. Yes. She was sure now that this was Steve, but her doubts would return unless he really went away. We need a secret code, so you know it's me. Okay. I'll think of something.
Okay.
Goodbye, he said. I won't try to kiss you. He went down the stairs. Call me, he shouted. She stood still, frozen to the spot, until she heard the slam of the street door. She bit her lip. She felt like crying. She went to the kitchen counter and poured coffee into a mug. She raised the mug to her lips, but it slipped through her fingers and fell to the floor, where it smashed on the tiles. Fuck, she said. Her legs went weak, and she slumped on the couch. She had felt in terrible danger, Now she knew the danger had been imaginary, but she still felt profoundly grateful that it had passed. Her body felt swollen with unfulfilled desire. She touched her crotch. Her leggings were damp. Soon, she breathed. Soon. She thought about how it would be the next time they met, how she would embrace him and kiss him and apologize, and how tenderly he would forgive her. And as she envisioned it, she touched herself with her fingertips, and after a few moments, a spasm of pleasure went through her. Then she slept for a while. 46. It was the humiliation that got to Barrington. He kept defeating Jeannie Farami, but he was never able to feel good about it. She had forced him to go sneaking around like a petty thief. He had surreptitiously leaked a story to a newspaper, crept into her office and searched her desk drawers, and now he was watching her house. But fear compelled him. His world seemed about to fall around him. He was desperate. He would never have thought he would be doing this a few weeks from his 60th birthday, sitting in his car, parked at the curb, watching someone else's front door like a grubby private eye. What would his mother think? She was still alive, a slim, well-dressed woman of 84, living in a small town in Maine, writing witty letters to the local newspaper and determinedly hanging on to her post as chief flower arranger for the Episcopalian Church. She would shudder with shame to know what her son had been reduced to. God forbid he should be seen by anyone he knew. He was careful not to meet the eyes of passers-by. His car was unfortunately conspicuous. He thought of it as a discreetly elegant automobile. But there were not many silver Lincoln town cars parked along this street. Aging Japanese compacts and lovingly preserved Pontiac Firebirds were the local favorites. Barrington himself was not the kind of person to fade into the background with his distinctive gray hair. For a while, he had held a street map open in front of him, resting on the steering wheel for camouflage. But this was a friendly neighborhood, and two people had tapped on the window and offered to give him directions, so he had had to put the map away. He consoled himself with the thought that anyone who lived in such a low-rent area could not possibly be important. He now had no idea what Jeannie was up to. The FBI had failed to find that list in her apartment. Barrington had to assume the worst. The list had led her to another clone. If that were so, disaster was not far away. Barrington, Jim, and Preston were staring close up at public exposure, disgrace, and ruin. It was Jim who had suggested that Barrington watch Jeannie's house. "We have to know what she's up to, who comes and goes," Jim had said, and Barrington had reluctantly agreed. He had got here early, and nothing had happened until around midday, when Jeannie was dropped off by a black woman he recognized as one of the detectives investigating the rape. She had interviewed him briefly on Monday. He had found her attractive. He managed to remember her name, Sergeant Delaware. He called Proust from the payphone in the McDonald's on the corner, and Proust promised to get his FBI friend to find out whom they had been to see. Barrington imagined the FBI man saying, "Sergeant Delaware made contact today with a suspect we have under surveillance. For security reasons, I can't reveal any more than that, but it would be helpful to us to know exactly what she did this morning and what case she was working on." An hour or so later, Jeannie had left in a rush, looking heartbreakingly sexy in a purple sweater. Barrington had not followed her car. Despite his fears, he could not bring himself to do something so undignified. But she had come back a few minutes later, carrying a couple of brown paper sacks from a grocery store. The next arrival was one of the clones, presumably Steve Logan. He had not stayed long. If I'd been in his shoes, Barrington thought, with Jeannie dressed like that, I would have stayed there all night, and most of Sunday. He checked the car's clock for the 20th time and decided to call Jim again. He might have heard from the FBI by now. Barrington left his car and walked to the corner. The smell of French fries made him hungry, but he did not like to eat hamburgers out of styrofoam containers. He got a cup of black coffee and went to the payphone. "They went to New York," Jim told him. It was as Barrington had feared. Wayne Statner, he said. Yep. Shit. What did they do? Asked him to account for his movements last Sunday. And like that. He was at the Emmys. Had his picture in People magazine. End of story. Any indication what Jeannie might be planning to do next? No. What's happening there? Not a lot. I can see her door from here. She did some shopping. Steve Logan came and went. Nothing. Maybe they've run out of ideas. And maybe not. All we know is that your scheme of firing her didn't shut her up. All right, Jim, don't rub it in. Wait. She's coming out. She had changed her clothes. She was wearing white jeans and a royal blue sleeveless blouse that showed her strong arms. Follow her, Jim said. The hell with that. She's getting into her car. Barry, we have to know where she goes. I'm not a cop, goddammit. A little girl on her way to the ladies' room with her mother said, That man shouted, Mommy. Hush, darling, her mother said. Barrington lowered his voice. She's pulling away. Get in your damn car. Fuck you, Jim. Follow her. Jim hung up. Barrington cradled the phone. Jeannie's red Mercedes went by and turned south on Falls Road. Barrington ran to his car. 47. Jeannie studied Steve's father. Charles was dark-haired, with the shadow of a heavy beard on his jaw. His expression was dour and his manner rigidly precise. Although it was Saturday and he had been gardening, he wore neatly pressed dark pants and a short-sleeved shirt with a collar. He did not look like Steve in any way. The only thing Steve might have got from him was a taste for conservative clothes. Most of Jeannie's students wore ripped denim and black leather, but Steve favored khakis and button-downs. Steve had not yet come home, and Charles speculated that he might have dropped by his law school library to read up on rape trials. Steve's mother was lying down. Charles made fresh lemonade, and he and Jeannie went out on the patio of the Georgetown house and sat on lawn chairs. Jeannie had woken up from her doze with a brilliant idea in the forefront of her mind. She had thought of a way to find the fourth clone, but she would need Charles's help, and she was not sure he would be willing to do what she had to ask him. Charles passed her a tall, cold glass, then took one himself and sat down. "May I call you by your first name?" he said. "Please do, and I hope you'll do the same." "Sure." They sipped their lemonade. Then he said, "Jeannie, what is this all about?" She put down her glass. "I think it's an experiment," she said. "Barrington and Proust were both in the military until shortly before they set up Genetico. I suspect the company was originally a cover for a military project." "I've been a soldier all my adult life, and I'm ready to believe almost anything crazy of the Army. But what interest could they have in women's fertility problems?" "Think of this. Steve and his doubles are tall, strong, fit, and handsome. They're also very smart, although their propensity to violence gets in the way of their achievements. But Steve and Dennis have IQ scores off the scale, and I suspect the other two would be the same. Wayne is already a millionaire at the age of 22, and the fourth one has at least been clever enough to totally evade detection." "Where does that get you?" "I don't know. I wonder if the Army was trying to breed the perfect soldier." It was no more than an idle speculation, and she said it casually, but it electrified Charles. "Oh, my God," he said, and an expression of shocked comprehension spread over his face. "I think I remember hearing about this." "What do you mean?" "There was a rumor, back in the 70s, that went all around the military. The Russians had a breeding program, people said. They were making perfect soldiers, perfect athletes, perfect chess players, everything. Some people said we should be doing the same. Others said we already were." "So that's it!" Jeannie felt that at last she was beginning to understand. They picked a healthy, aggressive, intelligent, blonde-haired man and woman and got them to donate the sperm and egg that went together to form the embryo. But what they were really interested in was the possibility of duplicating the perfect soldier once they had created him. The crucial part of the experiment was the multiple division of the embryo and the implanting into the host mothers. And it worked. She frowned. "I wonder what happened next," I can answer that, Charles said. Watergate. All those crazy secret schemes were canceled after that. But Genetico went legitimate, like the Mafia, and because they really did find out how to make test tube babies, the company was profitable. The profits financed the research into genetic engineering that they've been doing ever since. I suspect that my own project is probably part of their grand scheme. Which is what? A breed of perfect Americans. Intelligent, aggressive, and blonde. A master race. She shrugged. It's an old idea, but it's possible now with modern genetics. So why would they sell the company? It doesn't make sense. Maybe it does, Jeannie said thoughtfully. When they got the takeover bid, perhaps they saw it as an opportunity to move into high gear. The money will finance Proust's run at the presidency. If they get into the White House, they can do all the research they want and put their ideas into practice. Charles nodded. There's a piece about Proust's ideas in today's Washington Post. I don't think I want to live in his kind of world. If we're all aggressive, obedient soldiers, who's going to write the poems and play the blues and go on anti-war protest marches? Jeannie raised her eyebrows. It was a surprising thought to come from a career soldier. There's more to it than that, she said. Human variation has a purpose. There's a reason we're born different from both our parents. Evolution is a trial-and-error business. You can't prevent nature's failed experiments without eliminating the successes, too. Charles sighed. And all this means I'm not Steve's father. Don't say that. He opened his billfold and took out a photo. I have to tell you something, Jeannie. I never suspected any of this stuff about clones, but I've often looked at Steve and wondered if there was anything at all of me in him. Can't you see it? She said. A resemblance. No physical resemblance, but Steve has a profound sense of duty. None of the other clones could give a darn about duty. He got it from you. Charles still looked grim. There's bad in him. I know it. She touched his arm. Listen to me. Steve was what I call a wild child. Disobedient, impulsive, fearless, bursting with energy. Wasn't he? Charles smiled ruefully.
That's the truth.
So were Dennis Pinker and Wayne Statner. Such children are almost impossible to raise right. That's why Dennis is a murderer and Wayne a sadist. But Steve isn't like them, and you're the reason why. Only the most patient, understanding, and dedicated of parents can bring up such children to be normal human beings. But Steve is normal.
I pray you're right.
Charles opened his billfold to replace the photo. Jeannie forestalled him. May I see it?
Sure.
Jeannie studied the picture. It had been taken quite recently. Steve was wearing a blue-checked shirt, and his hair was a little too long. He was grinning shyly at the camera.
I don't have a photo of him, Jeannie said regretfully as she handed it back. Have that one.
I couldn't. You keep it next to your heart.
I have a million photos of Steve. I'll put another one in my billfold.
Thanks. I really appreciate it.
You seem very fond of him.
I love him, Charles.
You do.
Jeannie nodded. When I think he might be sent to jail for this rape, I want to offer to go instead of him. Charles gave a wry smile.
So do I.
That's love, isn't it?
Sure is.
Jeannie felt self-conscious. She had not meant to say all this to Steve's father. She had not really known it herself. It had just come out, and then she had realized it was true.
He said, "How does Steve feel about you?"
She smiled. I could be modest.
Don't bother.
He's crazy for me.
That doesn't surprise me. Not just because you're beautiful, though you are. You're strong, too. That's obvious. He needs someone strong, especially with this accusation over his head.
Jeannie gave him a calculating look. It was time to ask him.
There is something you could do, you know.
Tell me what it is. Jeannie had rehearsed this speech in the car all the way to Washington. If I could search another database, I might find the real rapist. But after the publicity in the New York Times, no government agency or insurance company is going to take the risk of working with me. Unless...
What?
Jeannie leaned forward in her lawn chair.
Genetico experimented on soldiers' wives who were referred to them by army hospitals. Therefore, most or all of the clones were probably born in army hospitals. He nodded slowly. The babies must have had army medical records 22 years ago. Those records may still exist.
I'm sure they do. The army never throws anything away.
Jeannie's hopes rose a notch, but there was another problem. That long ago, they would have been paper files. Might they have been transferred to computer?
I'm sure they have. It's the only way to store everything.
Then it is possible, Jeannie said, controlling her excitement. He looked thoughtful. She gave him a hard stare.
Charles, can you get me access? What exactly do you need to do?
I have to load my program into the computer, then let it search all the files.
How long does it take?
No way of knowing. That depends on the size of the database and the power of the computer.
Does it interfere with normal data retrieval?
It could slow it down.
He frowned.
Will you do it? Jeannie said impatiently.
If we're caught, it's the end of my career.
Will you?
Hell yes.
48. Steve was thrilled to see Jeannie sitting on the patio, drinking lemonade and talking earnestly to his father as if they were old friends.
This is what I want, he thought. I want Jeannie in my life. Then I can deal with anything.
He crossed the lawn from the garage, smiling, and kissed her lips softly.
You two look like conspirators, he said.
Jeannie explained what they were planning, and Steve allowed himself to feel hopeful again.
Dad said to Jeannie, I'm not computer literate. I'll need help loading your program.
I'll come with you.
I'll bet you don't have your passport here.
I sure don't.
I can't get you into the data center without identification.
I could go home and get it.
I'll come with you, Steve said to Dad. I have my passport upstairs. I'm sure I could load the program.
Dad looked askance at Jeannie.
She nodded.
The process is simple. If there are any glitches, you can call me from the data center and I'll talk you through it.
Okay.
Dad went into the kitchen and brought out the phone. He dialed a number.
Don, this is Charlie. Who won the golf?
I knew you could do it, but I'll beat you next week. You watch.
Listen, I need a favor. Kind of unusual. I want to check my son's medical records from way back when.
Yeah, he's got some kind of rare condition. Not life-threatening, but serious. And there may be a clue in his early history.
Would you arrange security clearance for me to go into the command data center?
There was a long pause. Steve could not read his father's face.
At last he said, Thanks, Don. I really appreciate it.
Steve punched the air and said,
Yes.
Dad put a finger to his lips, then went on speaking into the phone.
Steve will be with me. We'll be there in 15 or 20 minutes, if that's all right. Thanks again.
He hung up. Steve ran up to his room and came back with his passport. Jeannie had the disks in a small plastic box. She handed them to Steve. Put the one marked number one in the disk drive, and the instructions will come up on the screen. He looked at his father.
Ready? Let's go.
Good luck, Jeannie said.
They got into the Lincoln Mark 8 and drove to the Pentagon. They parked in the biggest parking lot in the world. In the Midwest, there were towns smaller than the Pentagon parking lot. They went up a flight of steps to a second-floor entrance. When he was 13, Steve had been taken on a visitor's tour of the place by a tall young man with an impossibly short haircut. The building consisted of five concentric rings linked by 10 corridors like the spokes of a wheel. There were five floors and no elevators. He had lost his sense of direction within seconds. The main thing he remembered was that in the middle of the central courtyard was a building called Ground Zero, which was a hot dog stand. Now his father led the way past a closed barber shop, a restaurant, and a metro entrance to a security checkpoint. Steve showed his passport and was signed in as a visitor and given a pass to stick to his shirt front. There were relatively few people here on a Saturday evening, and the corridors were deserted but for a few late workers, mostly in uniform, and one or two of the golf carts used for transporting bulky objects and VIPs. Last time he was here, Steve had been reassured by the monolithic might of the building. It was all there to protect him. Now he felt differently. Somewhere in this maze of rings and corridors, a plot had been hatched. The plot that had created him and his doppelgangers. This bureaucratic haystack existed to hide the truth he sought, and the men and women in crisp Army, Navy, and Air Force uniforms were now his foes. They went along a corridor, up a staircase, and around a ring to another security point. This one took longer. Steve's full name and address had to be keyed in, and they waited a minute or two for the computer to clear him. End of Side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette. Side 9. The Third Twin by Ken Follett. Continuing on page 326. For the first time in his life, he felt that a security check was aimed at him. He was the one they were looking for. He felt furtive and guilty, although he had done nothing wrong. It was a weird sensation. Criminals must feel like this all the time, he thought, and spies and smugglers and unfaithful husbands. They passed on, turned several more corners, and came to a pair of glass doors. Beyond the doors, a dozen or so young soldiers were sitting in front of computer screens, keying in data or feeding paper documents into optical character recognition machines. A guard outside the door checked Steve's passport yet again, then let them in. The room was carpeted and quiet, windowless and softly lit, with a characterless atmosphere of purified air. The operation was being run by a colonel, a gray-haired man with a pencil-lined mustache. He did not know Steve's father, but he was expecting him. His tone was brisk as he directed them to the terminal they would use. Perhaps he regarded their visit as a nuisance. Dad told him, "We need to search the medical records of babies born in military hospitals around 22 years ago. Those records are not held here." Steve's heart sank. Surely they could not be defeated that easily. "Where are they held?" "In St. Louis. Can't you access them from here? You need priority clearance to use the data link. You don't have that." "I didn't anticipate this problem, Colonel," Dad said testily. "Do you want me to call General Croner again? He may not thank us for bothering him unnecessarily on a Saturday night, but I will if you insist." The colonel weighed a minor breach of rules against the risk of irritating a general. "I guess that'll be okay. The line isn't being used, and we need to test it sometime this weekend." "Thank you." The colonel called over a woman in lieutenant's uniform and introduced her as Caroline Gamble. She was about 50, overweight, and corseted, with a manner of a headmistress. Dad repeated what he had told the colonel. Lieutenant Gamble said, "Are you aware that those records are governed by the Privacy Act, sir?" "Yes, and we have authorization." She sat at the terminal and touched the keyboard. After a few minutes, she said, "What kind of search do you want to run?" "We have our own search program." "Yes, sir. I'll be glad to load that for you." Dad looked at Steve. Steve shrugged and handed the woman the floppy disks. As she was loading the program, she looked curiously at Steve. "Who wrote this software?" "A professor at Jones Falls." "It's very clever," she said. "I've never seen anything quite like it." She looked at the colonel, who was watching over her shoulder. "Have you, sir?" He shook his head. "It's loaded. Shall I run the search?"
"Go ahead."
Lieutenant Gamble pressed enter. 49. A hunch made Barrington follow Colonel Logan's black Lincoln Mark 8 when it emerged from the driveway of the Georgetown house. He was not sure whether Jeannie was in the car. He could see only the colonel and Steve in the front, but it was a coupe, and she might have been in the back. He was glad to have something to do. The combination of inactivity and pressing anxiety was wearying. His back ached, and his legs were stiff. He wished he could give it all up and go. He might be sitting in a restaurant with a good bottle of wine, or at home listening to a CD of Mahler's Ninth Symphony, or undressing Pippa Harpenden. But then he thought of the rewards that the takeover would bring. First, there would be the money. $60 million was his share. Then the chance of political power, with Jim Proust in the White House and himself as Surgeon General. Finally, if they succeeded, a new and different America for the 21st century. America as it used to be, strong and brave and pure. So he gritted his teeth and persisted with this grubby exercise in snooping. For a while, he found it relatively easy to track Logan through the slow-moving Washington traffic. He stayed two cars behind, as in the gumshoe movies. The Mark 8 was elegant, he thought idly. Maybe he should trade in his town car. The sedan had presence, but it was middle-aged. The coupe was more dashing. He wondered how much he would get trading in the town car. Then he remembered that by Monday night, he would be rich. He could buy a Ferrari if he wanted to look dashing. Then the Mark 8 went through a light and around a corner. The light turned red. The car in front of Barrington stopped, and he lost sight of Logan's car. He cursed and leaned on his horn. He had been wool-gathering. He shook his head to clear it. The tedium of surveillance was sapping his concentration. When a light turned green again, he screeched around the corner and accelerated hard. A few moments later, he saw the black coupe waiting at a light, and he breathed easier. They drove around the Lincoln Memorial, then crossed the Potomac by Arlington Bridge. Were they heading for National Airport? They took Washington Boulevard, and Barrington realized their destination must be the Pentagon. He followed them down the off-ramp into the Pentagon's immense parking lot. He found a slot in the next lane, turned off his engine, and watched. Steve and his father got out of the car and headed for the building. He checked the Mark 8. There was no one left inside. Jeannie must have stayed behind at the house in Georgetown. What were Steve and his father up to? And Jeannie? He walked 20 or 30 yards behind them. He hated this. He dreaded being spotted. What would he say if they confronted him? It would be unbearably humiliating. Thankfully, neither of them looked back. They went up a flight of stairs and entered the building. He stayed with them until they passed through a security barrier and he had to turn back. He found a payphone and called Jim Proust. I'm at the Pentagon. I followed Jeannie to the Logan house, then trailed Steve Logan and his father here. I'm worried, Jim. The colonel works at the Pentagon, doesn't he? Yeah. It could be innocent. But why would he go to his office on a Saturday evening? For a poker game in the general's office, if I remember my army days. You don't take your kid to a poker game, no matter what age he is. What's at the Pentagon that could harm us? Records. No, Jim said. The army has no record of what we did. I'm sure of that. We have to know what they're doing. Isn't there some way you can find out? I guess. If I don't have friends at the Pentagon, I don't have them anywhere. I'll make some calls. Stay in touch. Barrington hung up and stood staring at the phone. The frustration was maddening. Everything he had worked for all his life was imperiled. And what was he doing? Following people around like a grubby private eye. But there was nothing else he could do. Seething with helpless impatience, he turned around and went back to his car to wait. 50. Steve waited in a fever of anticipation. If this worked, it would tell him who raped Lisa Hoxton, and then he would have a chance of proving his innocence. But what if it went wrong? The search might not work, or medical records might have been lost or wiped from the database. Computers were always giving you dumb messages, not found or out of memory or general protection fault. The terminal made a doorbell sound. Steve looked at the screen. The search had finished. On the screen was a list of names and addresses in pairs. Jeannie's program had worked. But were the clones on the list? He controlled his eagerness. The first priority was to make a copy of the list. He found a box of new diskettes in a drawer and slid one into the disk drive. He copied the list onto the disk, ejected it, and slid it into the back pocket of his jeans. Only then did he begin to study the names. He did not recognize any of them. He scrolled down. There seemed to be several pages. It would be easier to scan a piece of paper. He called Lieutenant Gamble. Can I print from this terminal? Sure, she said. You can use that laser printer. She came over and showed him how. Steve stood over the laser printer, watching avidly as the pages came out. He was hoping to see his own name listed alongside three others, Dennis Pinker, Wayne Statner, and the man who raped Lisa Hoxton. His father watched over his shoulder. The first page contained only pairs, no groups of three or four. The name, Stephen Logan, appeared halfway down the second page. Dad spotted it at the same time. There you are, he said with suppressed excitement. But there was something wrong. There were too many names grouped together. Along with Stephen Logan, Dennis Pinker, and Wayne Statner were Henry Irwin King, Per Erickson, Murray Claude, Harvey John Jones, and George DeSalt. Steve's elation turned to bafflement. Dad frowned.
Who are they all?
Steve counted. There are 8 names.
8?
Dad said.
8?
Then Steve saw it.
That's how many Genetico made, he said. 8 of us.
8 clones, Dad said in amazement.
What the hell did they think they were doing?
I wonder how the search found them, Steve said. He looked at the last sheet out of the printer. At the foot it said, Common Characteristic, Electrocardiogram.
That's right, I remember,
Dad said. You had an electrocardiogram when you were a week old. I never knew why. We all did, and identical twins have similar hearts.
I still can't believe it, Dad said.
There are 8 boys in the world exactly like you. Look at these addresses, Steve said. All army bases. Most of those people won't be at the same address now. Doesn't the program pull out any other information?
No.
That's how come it doesn't invade people's privacy. So how does she track them down? I asked her that. At the university, they have every phone book on CD-ROM. If that fails, they use driving license registries, credit reference agencies, and other sources.
The heck with privacy, Dad said. I'm going to pull these people's full medical histories, see if we get any clues.
I could use a cup of coffee, Steve said. Is there any around?
No beverages are allowed in the data center.
Spilled liquids play havoc with computers. There's a little rest area with a coffee maker and a Coke machine around the corner. I'll be right back. Steve left the data center with a nod to the guard at the door. The rest area had a couple of tables and a few chairs, and machines selling soda and candy. He ate 2 Snickers bars and drank a cup of coffee, then headed back to the data center. He stopped outside the glass doors. Several new people were inside, including a general and 2 armed military policemen. The general was arguing with Dad, and the colonel with a pencil-lined mustache seemed to be speaking at the same time. Their body language made Steve wary. Something bad was happening. He stepped into the room and stood by the door. Instinct told him not to draw attention to himself. He heard the general say, "I have my orders, Colonel Logan, and you're under arrest." Steve went cold. How had this happened? It was not just that they had discovered Dad was peeking at people's medical records. That might be a serious matter, but it was hardly an arresting offense. There was more to this. Somehow, Genetico had arranged it. What should he do? Dad was saying angrily, "You don't have the right." The general shouted back at him, "Don't lecture me about my goddamn rights, Colonel." There was no point in Steve joining in the argument. He had the floppy disk with the list of names right in his pocket. Dad was in trouble, but he could look after himself. Steve should just get out of there with the information. He turned and went out through the glass doors. He walked briskly, trying to look as if he knew where he was going. He felt like a fugitive. He struggled to remember how he had got here through the maze. He turned a couple of corners and walked through a security checkpoint.
"Just a minute, sir,"
the guard said. Steve stopped and turned, heart racing.
"Yes?"
he said, trying to sound like a busy person, impatient to get on with his work.
"I need to log you out on the computer. May I see your identification?"
"Of course." Steve handed over his passport. The guard checked his picture, then keyed his name into the computer.
"Thank you, sir," he said, handing back the passport.
Steve walked away along the corridor. 1 more checkpoint and he was out. Behind him, he heard the voice of Caroline Gamble.
"Mr. Logan, 1 moment, please."
He glanced back over his shoulder. She was running along the corridor behind him, red-faced and puffing. "Oh, shit," he said. He darted around a corner and found a staircase. He ran down the steps to the next floor. He had the names that could clear him of the rape charge. He was not going to let anyone stop him getting out of here with the information. Not even the U.S. Army. To leave the building, he needed to get to Ring E, the outermost. He hurried along a spoke corridor, passing Ring C. A golf cart loaded with cleaning materials went by in the opposite direction. When he was halfway to Ring D, he heard Lieutenant Gamble's voice again.
"Mr. Logan!"
She was still following him. She shouted down the long, wide corridor,
"The general wishes to speak with you."
A man in an Air Force uniform glanced curiously through an office door. Fortunately, there were relatively few people around on a Saturday evening. Steve found a staircase and went up. That ought to slow the pudgy lieutenant. On the next floor, he hurried along the corridor to ring D, followed the ring around two corners, then went down again. There was no further sign of Lieutenant Gamble. He had shaken her off, he thought with relief. He was pretty sure he was on the exit level. He went clockwise around ring D to the next corridor. It looked familiar. This was the way he had come in. He followed the corridor outward and came to the security checkpoint where he had entered. He was almost free. Then he saw Lieutenant Gamble. She was standing at the checkpoint with the guard, flushed and breathless. Steve cursed. He had not shaken her off after all. She had simply got to the exit ahead of him. He decided to brazen it out. He walked up to the guard and took off his visitor's badge. "You can keep that on," Lieutenant Gamble said. "The general would like to speak with you." Steve put the badge down on the counter. Masking his fear with a show of confidence, he said, "I'm afraid I don't have time. Goodbye, Lieutenant, and thank you for your cooperation." "I must insist," she said. Steve pretended to be impatient. "You're not in a position to insist," he said. "I'm a civilian. You can't command me. I've done nothing wrong, so you can't arrest me. I'm not carrying any military property, as you can see." He hoped the floppy disk in his back pocket was not visible. "It would be illegal of you to attempt to detain me." She spoke to the guard, a man of about 30 who was 3 or 4 inches shorter than Steve. "Don't let him leave," she said. Steve smiled at the guard. "If you touch me, soldier, it will be assault. I'll be justified in punching you out. And believe me, I'll do it." Lieutenant Gamble looked around for reinforcements, but the only people in sight were two cleaners and an electrician working on a light fixture. Steve walked toward the entrance. Lieutenant Gamble cried, "Stop him!" Behind him, he heard the guard shout, "Stop, or I'll shoot!" Steve turned. The guard had drawn a pistol and was pointing it at him. The cleaners and the electrician froze, watching. The guard's hands were shaking as he pointed the gun at Steve. Steve felt his muscles seize up as he stared down the barrel. With an effort, he shook off his paralysis. A Pentagon guard would not fire at an unarmed civilian. He was sure. "You won't shoot me," he said. "It would be murder." He turned and walked to the door. It was the longest walk of his life. The distance was only 3 or 4 yards, but it felt as if it took years. The skin on his back seemed to burn with anticipation. As he put his hand on the door, a shot rang out. Someone screamed. The thought flashed through Steve's mind. "He fired over my head, but he did not look back. He flew through the door and ran down a long flight of steps. Night had fallen while he was inside, and the parking lot was lit by street lamps. He heard shouting behind him, then another shot. He reached the bottom of the stairway and veered off the footpath into the bushes. He emerged onto a road and kept running. He came to a row of bus stops. He slowed to a walk. A bus was pulling up at one of the stops. Two soldiers got off, and a woman civilian got on. Steve boarded right behind her. The bus pulled away. The bus drove out of the parking lot and onto the expressway, leaving the Pentagon behind. 51. In a couple of hours, Jeannie had come to like Lorraine Logan enormously. She was much heavier than she seemed in the photograph that appeared at the top of her Lonely Hearts column in the newspapers. She smiled a lot, causing her chubby face to crease up. To take Jeannie's mind and her own off their worries, she talked of the problems people wrote to her about. Domineering in-laws, violent husbands, impotent boyfriends, bosses with wandering hands, daughters who took drugs. Whatever the subject, Lorraine managed to say something that made Jeannie think, "Of course, how come I never saw it that way before?" They sat on the patio as the day cooled, waiting anxiously for Steve and his father to return. Jeannie told Lorraine about the rape of Lisa. "She'll try for as long as she can to act as if it never happened," Lorraine said. "Yes, that's exactly how she is now. That phase can last 6 months, but sooner or later she'll realize she has to stop denying what happened and come to terms with it. That stage often begins when the woman tries to resume normal sex and finds she doesn't feel the way she used to. That's when they write to me. What do you advise?
Counseling.
There isn't an easy solution. Rape damages a woman's soul, and it has to be mended.
The detective recommended counseling.
Lorraine raised her eyebrows. He's a pretty smart cop.
Jeannie smiled.
She.
Lorraine laughed. We reprove men for making sexist assumptions. I beg you, don't tell anyone what I just did.
I promise.
There was a short silence. Then Lorraine said,
Steve loves you.
Jeannie nodded.
Yeah, I think he really does.
A mother can tell.
So he's been in love before.
You don't miss a trick, do you?
Lorraine smiled. Yes, he has, but only once.
Tell me about her, if you think he wouldn't mind.
Okay.
Her name was Fanny Gallagher. She had green eyes and wavy dark red hair. She was vivacious and careless, and she was the only girl in high school who wasn't interested in Steve. He pursued her, and she resisted him for months. But he won her in the end, and they dated for about a year.
Do you think they slept together?
I know they did. They used to spend nights together here. I don't believe in forcing kids to make out in parking lots.
What about her parents?
I talked to Fanny's mother.
She felt the same way about it.
I lost my virginity in the alley behind a punk rock club at the age of 14. It was such a depressing experience that I didn't have sexual intercourse again until I was 21. I wish my mother had been more like you.
I don't think it really matters whether parents are strict or lenient, as long as they are consistent. Kids can live with more or less any set of rules, so long as they know what they are. It's arbitrary tyranny that gets them mixed up.
Why did Steve and Fanny break up?
He had a problem. He should probably tell you about it himself.
Are you talking about the fight with Tip Hendricks?
Lorraine raised her eyebrows.
He told you. My goodness, he really trusts you.
They heard a car outside. Lorraine got up and went to the corner of the house to look out into the street.
Steve's come home in a taxi cab, she said in a puzzled tone.
Jeannie stood up. How does he look? Before Lorraine could answer, he appeared on the patio.
Where's your father? She asked him.
Dad got arrested.
Jeannie said, Oh, God, why?
I'm not sure. I think the genetical people somehow found out, or guessed, what we were up to and pulled some strings. They sent 2 military police to grab him, but I got away.
Lorraine said suspiciously, Stevie, there's something you aren't telling me.
A guard fired 2 shots.
Lorraine gave a small scream.
I think he was aiming over my head. Anyway, I'm fine.
Jeannie's mouth went dry. The thought of bullets being fired at Steve horrified her. He might have died.
The sweep worked, though.
Steve took a diskette from his back pocket.
Here's the list, and wait till you hear what's on it.
Jeannie swallowed hard.
What? There aren't 4 clones.
How come?
There are 8.
Jeannie's jaw dropped.
8 of you? We found 8 identical electrocardiograms. Genetico had split the embryo 7 times and implanted 8 unknowing women with the children of strangers. The arrogance was unbelievable. But Jeannie's suspicion had been proved. This was what Barrington was so desperate to conceal. When this news was made public, Genetico would be disgraced, and Jeannie would be vindicated, and Steve would be cleared.
You did it, she said.
She hugged him. Then a snag occurred to her. But which of the 8 committed the rape?
We'll have to find out, Steve said, and that won't be easy. The addresses we have are the places where their parents lived at the time they were born. They're almost certainly out of date.
We can try to track them down.
That's Lisa's specialty.
Jeannie stood up.
I'd better get back to Baltimore. This is going to take most of the night.
I'll come with you.
What about your father? You have to get him out of the hands of the military police.
Lorraine said, You're needed here, Steve. I'm going to call our lawyer right now. I have his home number, but you'll have to tell him what happened.
All right, he said reluctantly. I should call Lisa before I leave, so she can get ready, Jeannie said.
The phone was on the patio table.
May I?
Of course. She dialed Lisa's number. The phone rang 4 times. Then there was the characteristic pause of an answering machine kicking in.
Damn, Jeannie said as she listened to Lisa's message. When it finished, she said, "Lisa, please call me. I'm leaving Washington now. I'll be home around 10. Something really important has happened." She hung up. Steve said, "I'll walk you to your car." She said goodbye to Lorraine, who hugged her warmly. Outside, Steve handed her the diskette. "Take care of that," he said. "There's no copy, and we won't get another chance." She put it in her bag. "Don't worry. It's my future, too." She kissed him hard. "Oh, boy," he said after a while. "Could we do a lot of this quite soon?" "Yes, but don't endanger yourself meanwhile. I don't want to lose you. Be careful." He smiled. "I love it that you're worried about me. It's almost worth it." She kissed him again, softly this time. "I'll call you." She got in the car and pulled away. She drove fast and got home in under an hour. She was disappointed to find there was no message from Lisa on her machine. She worried that maybe Lisa was asleep or watching TV and not listening to her messages. "Don't panic. Think." She ran out again and drove to Lisa's place, an apartment building in Charles Village. She rang the entry phone at the street door, but there was no answer. Where the hell had Lisa gone? She did not have a boyfriend to take her out on a Saturday night. Please God, she hasn't gone to see her mother in Pittsburgh. Lisa lived in 12B. Jeannie rang the bell of 12A. Again, there was no reply. Maybe the damn system was not working. Seething with frustration, she tried 12C. A grouchy male voice said, "Yeah, who is it?" "I'm sorry to trouble you, but I'm a friend of Lisa Hoxton next door to you, and I need to reach her really urgently. Would you happen to know where she is?" The voice replied, "Where do you think you are, lady? Hicksville, USA? I don't even know what my neighbor looks like." Click. "Where are you from? New York?" she said angrily to the unheeding loudspeaker. She went home, driving as if she were in a race, and called Lisa's answering machine again. "Lisa, please call me the second you get in, no matter what time of night. I'll be waiting by the phone." After that, there was no more she could do. Without Lisa, she could not even get into Nut House. She took a shower and wrapped herself in her pink bathrobe. She felt hungry and microwaved a frozen cinnamon bun, but eating nauseated her, so she threw it away and drank coffee with milk in it. She wished she had a TV to distract her. She got out the picture Charles had given her of Steve. She would have to get a frame for it. She stuck it to the refrigerator door with a fridge magnet. That started her looking at her photograph albums. She smiled to see Daddy in a brown chalk-striped suit with broad lapels and flared pants, standing beside the turquoise Thunderbird. There were several pages of Jeannie in tennis whites, triumphantly holding a series of silver cups and plaques. Here was Mom pushing Patty in an old-fashioned stroller. There was Will Temple in a cowboy hat, cutting up and making Jeannie laugh. The phone rang. She leaped up, dropping the album on the floor, and snatched up the handset. "Lisa?" "Hi, Jeannie. What's the big emergency?" She collapsed on the couch, weak with gratitude. "Thank God. I called you hours ago. Where have you been?" "I went to a movie with Catherine and Bill. Is that a crime?" "I'm sorry. I have no right to cross-examine you." "It's okay. I'm your friend. You can get ratty with me. I'll do it to you one day." Jeannie laughed. "Thanks. Listen, I have a list of 5 names of people who might be Steve's double." She was deliberately understating the case. The truth was too hard to swallow in one lump. "I need to track them down tonight. Will you help me?" There was a pause. "Jeannie, I almost got into serious trouble when I tried to get into your office. I could have got myself and the security guard fired. I want to help you, but I need this job." Jeannie felt coldly fearful. "No, you can't let me down. Not when I'm this close. Please? I'm scared." Fear was replaced by fierce determination. "Hell, I'm not going to let you get away with this. Lisa, it's almost Sunday. I don't like doing this to you, but I have to. A week ago, I walked into a burning building to look for you." "I know, I know. I was scared then." There was a long silence. "You're right," Lisa said at last. "Okay, I'll do it." Jeannie suppressed a victory whoop. How soon can you get there? 15 minutes. I'll meet you outside. Jeannie hung up. She ran into the bedroom, dropped her robe on the floor, and pulled on black jeans and a turquoise T-shirt. She threw on a black Levi's jacket and ran downstairs. She left the house at midnight. Sunday, 52. She reached the university before Lisa. She parked in the visitor's lot, not wanting her distinctive car to be seen outside Nutt House, then walked across the dark, deserted campus. While she waited impatiently outside the front of the building, she wished she had stopped off to buy something to eat. She had had nothing all day. She thought wistfully of a cheeseburger with French fries, a slice of pizza with pepperoni, apple pie with vanilla ice cream, or even a big garlicky Caesar salad. At last, Lisa drove up in her smart white Honda. She got out of the car and took Jeannie by the hands. "I feel ashamed," she said. "You shouldn't have had to remind me what a friend you've been to me." "I understand, though," Jeannie said. "I'm sorry." Jeannie hugged her. They went inside and turned on the lights in the lab. Jeannie started the coffee machine while Lisa booted up her computer. It felt weird to be in the lab in the middle of the night. The antiseptic white decor, the bright lights, and the silent machines all around made her think of a morgue. She thought they would probably get a visit from security sooner or later. After Jeannie's break-in, they would be keeping an eye on Nutt House, and they would see the lights. But it was not unusual for scientists to work odd hours in the lab, and there would be no trouble, unless the guard happened to recognize Jeannie from last night. "If a security guard comes to check on us, I'm going to hide in the stationery cupboard," she said to Lisa, "just in case the guard is someone who knows I'm not supposed to be here." "I hope we get enough warning of his approach," Lisa said nervously. "We should arrange some kind of alarm." Jeannie was eager to get on with searching for the clones, but she contained her impatience. This would be a sensible precaution. She looked around the lab thoughtfully, and her eye fell upon a small flower arrangement on Lisa's desk. "How much do you love that glass vase?" she said. Lisa shrugged. "I got it in Kmart. I can get another." Jeannie dumped the flowers and emptied the water into a sink. She took from a shelf a copy of Identical Twins Reared Apart by Susan L. Farber. She went to the end of the corridor where a pair of swing doors gave onto the staircase. She pulled the doors a little inward and used the book to wedge them there. Then she balanced the vase on the top edge of the doors, straddling the gap. There was no way anyone could come in without causing the vase to fall and smash. Watching her, Lisa said, "What'll I say if they ask me why I did that?" "You didn't want anyone to sneak up on you," Jeannie replied. Lisa nodded, satisfied. "God knows, I have reason enough to be paranoid." "Let's get going," Jeannie said. They went back into the lab, leaving the door open to be sure they would hear the glass breaking. Jeannie put her precious floppy disk into Lisa's computer and printed the Pentagon results. There were the names of the 8 babies whose electrocardiograms were as similar as if they had all come from one person. 8 tiny hearts beating exactly the same way. Somehow, Barrington had arranged for the Army hospitals to give these babies this test. No doubt copies had been sent to the Aventine Clinic, where they had remained until they were shredded on Thursday. But Barrington had forgotten, or perhaps never realized, that the Army would keep the original graphs. "Let's start with Henry King," she suggested. "Full name, Henry Irwin King." On her desk, Lisa had 2 CD-ROM drives, one on top of the other. She took 2 CDs from her desk drawer and put one in each drive. "We have every residential phone in the United States on those 2 disks," she said, "and we have software that enables us to search both disks at the same time." A Windows screen appeared on the monitor. "People don't always put their full name in the phone book, unfortunately," she said. "Let's just see how many H. Kings there are in the United States." She typed H*King and clicked on Count. After a moment, a count window appeared with a number 1,129. Jeannie was discouraged. "It will take all night to call that many numbers." "Wait, we may be able to do better." Lisa typed, "Henry I. King or Henry Irwin King," and clicked on the retrieve icon, a picture of a dog. After a moment, a list appeared on the screen. "We have 3 Henry Irwin Kings and 17 Henry I. Kings." What's his last known address? Jeannie consulted her printout. Fort Devens, Massachusetts. Okay, we have one Henry Irwin King in Amherst and four Henry I. Kings in Boston. Let's call them. You do realize it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I can't wait until tomorrow. People won't talk to you at this time of night. Sure they will, Jeannie said. It was bravado. She knew she would have trouble. She just was not prepared to wait until morning. This was too important. I'll say I'm from the police, tracking down a serial killer. That has to be against the law. Give me the Amherst number. Lisa highlighted the listing and pressed F2. There was a rapid series of beeps from the computer's modem. Jeannie picked up the phone. She heard 7 rings, then a sleepy voice answered. Yes? This is Detective Susan Farber of the Amherst Police Department, she said. She half expected him to say, the hell it is, but he made no response, and she went on briskly. We're sorry to call you in the middle of the night, but it's an urgent police matter. Am I speaking to Henry Irwin King? Yes. What's happened? It sounded like the voice of a middle-aged man, but Jeannie persisted just to be sure. This is just a routine inquiry. That was a mistake. Routine, he said tetchily. At this time of night? Improvising hastily, she said, we're investigating a serious crime, and we need to eliminate you as a suspect, sir. Could you tell me your date and place of birth? I was born in Greenfield, Massachusetts, on the 4th of May, 1945. Okay? You don't have a son of the same name, do you? No. I have 3 daughters. Can I go back to sleep now? We don't need to trouble you any further. Thank you for cooperating with the police, and have a good night's rest. She hung up and looked triumphantly at Lisa. See? He talked to me. He didn't like it, but he talked. Lisa laughed. Dr. Farami, you have a talent to deceive. Jeannie grinned. All it takes is chutzpah. Let's do the Henry I. Kings. I'll call the first 2. You take the last 2. Only one of them could use the automatic dialing feature. Jeannie found a scratch pad and a ballpoint and scribbled the 2 numbers. Then she picked up a phone and dialed manually. A male voice answered, and she went into her spiel. This is Detective Susan Farber of the Boston City Police. What the fuck are you doing calling me at this time of night? The man burst out. Do you know who I am? I assume you're Henry King. Assume you just lost your fucking job, you dumb cunt, he raged. Susan, who did you say? I just need to check on your date of birth, Mr. King. Let me speak to your lieutenant right away. Mr. King, do as I say. Goddamn gorilla, Jeannie said, and she hung up. She felt quite shaky. I hope it's not going to be a night of conversations like that. Lisa had already hung up. Mine was Jamaican and had the accent to prove it, she said. I gather yours was unpleasant. Very. We could stop now and continue in the morning. Jeannie was not going to be defeated by one rude man. Hell no, she said. I can take a little verbal abuse. Whatever you say. He sounded a lot older than 22, so we can forget him. Let's try the other 2. Bracing herself, she dialed again. Her 3rd Henry King had not yet gone to bed. There was music in the background and other voices in the room. Yeah, who's this? He said. He sounded about the right age, and Jeannie felt hopeful. She did her impersonation of a cop again, but he was suspicious. How do I know you're the police? He sounded just like Steve, and Jeannie's heart missed a beat. This could be one of the clones, but how should she deal with his suspicions? She decided to brazen it out. Would you like to call me back here at police headquarters? She offered recklessly. There was a pause. No, forget it, he said. Jeannie breathed again. I'm Henry King, he said. They call me Hank. What do you want? Could I first check your date and place of birth? I was born in Fort Devens exactly 22 years ago. It's my birthday, as a matter of fact. Well, it was yesterday, Saturday. It was him. Jeannie had found one clone already. Next, she had to establish whether he was in Baltimore last Sunday. She tried to keep the excitement out of her voice as she said, Could you tell me when you last traveled outside the state? Let me see. That was August. I went to New York. Jeannie's instinct said he was telling the truth, but she continued to question him. What were you doing last Sunday?
I was working.
What work do you do?
Well, I'm a graduate student at MIT, but I have a Sunday job, tending bar at the Blue Note Cafe in Cambridge.
Jeannie scribbled a note. And that's where you were last Sunday?
Yep. Served at least 100 people.
Thank you, Mr. King. If this was true, he was not the one who had raped Lisa. Would you just give me that phone number so I can confirm your alibi?
I don't recall the number, but it's in the book. What am I supposed to have done?
We're investigating a case of arson.
I'm glad I have an alibi.
She found it unnerving to hear Steve's voice and know she was listening to a stranger. She wished she could see Henry King to check the visual resemblance. Reluctantly, she drew the conversation to a close.
Thank you again, sir. Good night.
She hung up and blew out her cheeks, drained by the effort of deception.
Phew!
Lisa had been listening. You found him?
Yes. He was born in Fort Devens, and he's 22 today. He's the Henry King we're looking for, sure enough.
Good work!
But he seems to have an alibi.
He says he was working at a bar in Cambridge. She looked at her scratch pad. The Blue Note. Shall we check it out? Lisa's hunting instinct had been aroused, and she was keen. Jeannie nodded.
It's late, but I guess the bar should still be open, especially on a Saturday night. Can you get the number from your CD-ROM?
We only have residential numbers. Business listings are another set of disks.
Jeannie called information, got the number, and dialed it. The phone was answered right away.
This is Detective Susan Farber of the Boston Police. Let me speak to the manager, please.
This is the manager. What's wrong?
The man had a Hispanic accent, and he sounded worried.
Do you have an employee named Henry King?
Hank, yeah.
What do you do now?
It sounded as if Henry King had been in trouble with the law before.
Maybe nothing. When did you last see him?
Today. I mean, yesterday, Saturday. He was working the day shift.
And before that?
Let me see.
Last Sunday. He worked the 4 to midnight.
Would you swear to that if necessary, sir?
Sure, why not? Whoever got killed, Hank didn't do it.
Thank you for your cooperation, sir.
Hey, no problem. The manager seemed relieved. That was all she wanted. If I were a real cop, Jeannie thought, I'd guess he had a guilty conscience.
Call me any time. He hung up. Jeannie said disappointedly, alibi stands up.
Don't be downhearted, Lisa said. We've done very well to eliminate him so quickly, especially as it's such a common name.
Let's try Per Erickson. There won't be so many of them. The Pentagon list said Per Erickson had been born in Fort Rucker, but 22 years later, there were no Per Ericksons in Alabama. Lisa tried P*ERICS?ON, in case it should be spelled with a double S. Then she tried P*ERICS?N, to include the spellings ERICSEN and ERICSAN. But the computer found nothing. Try Philadelphia, Jeannie suggested. That's where he attacked me. There were three in Philadelphia. The first turned out to be a pater. The second was a frail, elderly voice on an answering machine. And the third was a woman, Petra. Jeannie and Lisa began to work their way through all the P. Ericksons in the United States, 33 listings. Lisa's second P. Erickson was bad-tempered and abusive, and she was white-faced as she hung up the phone.